From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the director of the new film, The Addams Family, Barry Sonnenfeld. It's his first time out as a director. His previous work has been as a cinematographer on such films as Misery, Big, and Miller's Crossing. Now, he says, he's turning into the cinematographer's nightmare. Also, how Hollywood's fear of losing money can lead it to make a movie that bombs at the box office. Film critic Julie Salomon's new book explains how that happened with the film The Bonfire of the Vanities. She was given unlimited access to the production. And Maureen Corrigan tells us about a new spellbinding biography of Edgar Allan Poe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Syria and Palestinian representatives have accepted a U.S. invitation to continue the Mideast peace talks beginning next week in Washington. The acceptances came after the United States refused to grant an Israeli request for a 5-day delay in the talks. Israeli officials have expressed anger at the U.S. decision to break an impasse over the site for the next talks by offering Washington as a location and setting an arbitrary date. It's expected that the Syrian and Palestinian acceptances will put more pressure on Israel to take part in the talks on Wednesday. In a joint declaration issued today at the White House, the United States and the United Kingdom demanded that Libya hand over the suspected masterminds of the Pan Am 103 bombing over Lockerbie, Scotland. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The declaration says that after consultations, the U.S. and United Kingdom demand that the government of Libya must surrender for trial all those charged with the bombing crime and accept responsibility for the actions of Libyan government officials. It also must disclose all it knows about the bombing, allowing full access to all witnesses, documents, and material evidence, and pay appropriate compensation. The statement says the U.S. and United Kingdom expect Libya to comply promptly and in full. The statement also includes a joint declaration with the two countries and France, in which all three reaffirm their complete condemnation of terrorism and their commitment to put an end to terrorism. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Congress will adjourn without passing a broad anti-crime package sought by the president. Although the legislation passed the House early this morning, Senate Republicans killed it, saying it was soft on criminals. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Legislation that would have applied the death penalty to 53 federal crimes and created a national 5-day waiting period for the purchase of handguns was stopped cold today in the Senate. Republicans blocked the bill from reaching the floor for a vote. President Bush had threatened to veto the bill, saying that provisions limiting death row appeals and giving police more latitude to seize evidence without a warrant had been weakened. Judiciary Chairman Joseph Biden said the bill was held back so that the president could continue to bash Democrats as being soft on crime.
It's ludicrous. It's once again a serious flaw in the judgment of the president. What amazes me is how many times the Republicans in the Senate are willing to lay themselves down on the track for the president.
The legislation would have authorized $3 billion for additional state and local law enforcement. Senator Biden pronounced it dead for the year. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street despite apparent improvements in the weekly unemployment figures and a gain in factory orders for durable goods. The Dow Industrials lost 16 points to finish at 2,900. This is NPR News. The United Nations Security Council recommended today that a UN peacekeeping force be sent to Yugoslavia on condition that the warring parties respect the current UN-brokered ceasefire. The 15-member council unanimously adopted a resolution that would authorize Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar to make plans to establish the peace force. Diplomats said that such a force could involve thousands of troops. The Security Council met after Yugoslavia requested it to act promptly to send peacekeepers. A federal judge has stopped the government from opening its first permanent nuclear dump site, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant in New Mexico, known as WIP. The judge ruled that only Congress can authorize sending radioactive waste to WIP for burial underground. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
WIP is a maze of tunnels more than a third of a mile beneath the New Mexican desert. The Department of Energy wants to put 900,000 barrels of radioactive plutonium-contaminated waste into the mine and seal it up. The government has been trying to open WIP since 1987, but Congress has been unwilling to give its permission until key scientific and safety issues are resolved. Last month, the government announced it would simply skirt Congress and open WIP immediately by using a legal maneuver. It transferred the title to federal land around the mine to the Energy Department, which runs the facility. New Mexico officials sued, and now a federal judge has ruled that WIP cannot open without congressional approval. The ruling means radioactive waste generated from decades of nuclear bomb making will continue to sit at plants across the country. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
Military officials at the Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba said today that Haitian refugees are rapidly filling the tent city that's being constructed to provide them with temporary shelter. Marine General George Walls said that he expected orders from Washington very shortly to fill the base to its maximum. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The TV series The Addams Family lasted only 2 seasons, but it made a lasting impression on a lot of baby boomers. This perverse family of nonconformists is back in the new movie The Addams Family, with Angelica Houston as Morticia Addams and Raul Julia as her husband Gomez. The Addams Family is the first feature film directed by my guest Barry Sonnenfeld. He's already well known as a cinematographer. He shot the films Big, Misery, When Harry Met Sally, Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, and Blood Simple. Sonnenfeld was a fan of the Addams Family TV show and its bizarre video cousin, the Munsters, but he first came across the Addams Family in cartoons drawn by Charles Addams in the New Yorker magazine, required reading, he says, for a young Jewish boy growing up on Manhattan's Upper West Side. I wanted to know if the director of the Addams Family thought of his own family as normal.
My family was definitely not normal, which is why I think I was a good choice to direct the Addams Family. I was an only child in a very overprotected home. So, for instance, my mother threatened to commit suicide if I went away to college. So I spent 3 years living at home, attending New York University, and then they had a separate campus in the Bronx, and when I was about to be a senior at NYU, NYU sold the campus, and I refused to go downtown to the downtown school, and it dawned on me that if I applied to colleges out of town, the worst that would happen was that I would be able to go away to college after all, and the best that would happen is I could kill 2 birds with 1 stone, and my mother would commit suicide as well. So it turned out that I applied to Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, was accepted, and my mother didn't commit suicide. In fact, both of my parents are presently alive, dreading every interview I ever give. But my background is sort of, my parents were sort of theatrical in both their personal lives and what they did as living. My dad is a lighting salesman and used to invest in failed Broadway shows. I remember their big hope was investing in a show called Bravo Giovanni that lasted about 10 performances. And so I grew up sort of in a world with artists and theatrical types and all that.
And flamboyant, neurotic people.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, I've read several interviews and stories where they talk about the Addams Family being a dysfunctional family, and I must say that's exactly the opposite of what I intended. I think the Addams Family are truly, as portrayed in our movie, the perfect family. The parents allow their children to sort of grow in their own way. They don't dictate any rules to the kids, and the husband and wife show tremendous love and affection towards each other. I truly think the Addams Family is a perfect family whose mores are slightly different than a lot of others.
Now, how did you end up making your directorial debut on such a big budget film? I think most people start smaller.
Yes, well, the way I got the job was by turning it down several times. I think in almost any profession, the more you turn a job down, the more people want you to do it. So when I originally was given the script to the Addams Family as Tarita's potential director, I felt it was too jokey and too much like the television show, so I kept saying no. And the more I said no, the more Orion and the producer, Scott Rudin, wanted me to do it, convincing me that we would, over the next 5 months, make the script better, funnier, more romantic, which we did. I also think I was hired by Orion Pictures, who started the production, because I seemed to be a nice boy. I sort of am adorable and charming, and I think the people at Orion just sort of liked me. And they also didn't think they were going to make a $30 million movie at the time.
What did they think it was going to cost?
I think when we first talked about making the movie, they thought they would make a sort of a low to medium budget, $15 to $20 million film, and would therefore take a chance on a first-time director. As we made the script bigger and started to design sets, we convinced them to put more and more money into it. And by the time we started production, our budget was more like $25 or $26 million. But by then, the ball was rolling, and there was no stopping us.
I think the scene I like best in the movie is a scene I believe that you actually wrote, and it's the high school play scene.
Yes, it's my favorite scene. I wanted to take the film outside the house and show the Addams family surrounded by what we would call normal people. So I thought it would be great to have Pugsley and Wednesday, the two children, do their version of a scene from Hamlet, which is, of course, the bloodiest version anyone's ever seen. Although it's not in any way gory, which is why I like the scene so much. In certain ways, we borrowed certain images from the Mel Brooks movie, The Producers. There's a scene in The Producers where they put on a Broadway musical called Springtime for Hitler. And at the very end of the scene, you cut to the audience and they're like an oil painting. They're just frozen in shock. And I sort of recreated that as the after Pugsley and Wednesday hack off each other's limbs, spewing blood all over the stage floor. We cut to the audience, which is dead, frozen, silent, except for the members of the Addams family who stand up and applaud. And it's a scene I really love because I think it's very true to the Charles Addams drawings and Charles Addams's sort of unusual vision of life.
Now, would you have been a kid like this who might have, in a high school play, created a scene with enormous amounts of special effects blood that would splatter all over the audience?
No, I was not in any way physically adept growing up. I was more of an intellectual. I was very thin. In fact, my parents would force me to go to Jones Beach during the summer, which is the big beach on Long Island, and while my parents would go to the beach because they wouldn't leave me home alone because I was like 14 or 15, you know, they would go to the beach. But I was so thin and physically awkward that I would stay in the parking lot in the car with the windows closed because I was also afraid of bees. But I still wanted to meet girls, so I always brought de Tocqueville's Democracy in America.
Oh, that's a good one to pick up girls.
I thought
yeah.
So. I imagine, you know, a girl with granny glasses and a peasant blouse sort of walking by saying, de Tocqueville? But it never happened.
You should write your memoirs.
My mother's afraid I will.
What are some of the most difficult decisions that you had to make as a director on the Addams Family? Decisions that you thought you might lose your mind over?
Well, see, here's what happens. You have all these great ideas when you're starting a movie about how you'll shoot certain scenes and how this scene will blend into this scene and what you're trying to state in this scene. And by the end of the first day, you just say, just if I can press a button and be done with this movie and it will just be ordinary and bland, let me press that button. Show me where that button is. Every day is a day of compromises because you find out that to do a shot the way you want to, the cameraman needs 4 hours to light it instead of 1 hour. So you say, okay, well, we'll do this instead, but then you didn't call Wednesday in at that time, so she's not on the set, so you can't do that shot. So you say, okay, we'll do something. So every day is just a terrible series of compromises. I remember when Orion was running out of money because the studio was in financial difficulty, I got a call one day from them saying, the set you're going to shoot at tomorrow, you can paint the pillars, but none of the walls.
Why?
Well, you know, the additional cost of paint.
Oh, God.
It had gotten that sort of scary. So for a while, we thought the movie was not going to be finished or released.
Well, I read that during a budget meeting with a production executive, you actually fainted.
Actually, if only that were, if only it was in a calm situation like at a budget meeting. We were on the set, and I was filming the movie. And the previous day, we had done a shot. The last shot of the day was a shot with Thing running down the hallway to answer the door. It's a wonderful shot, but it took 6 hours to light.
Thing is just a hand.
Thing is a disembodied hand, sort of their pet. In fact, we had a lot of debates whether Thing was a hand that used to exist on someone or if Thing was an entity unto itself, and decided Thing was always a hand, was born a hand, and never existed as part of an arm. So anyway, it took 6 hours to shoot this scene with Thing running down the hallway. And as I was leaving, I realized I had made a terrible mistake and should have let Thing leave frame. But I didn't. So the whole way home, I'm thinking, how do I get to the next shot? How do I physically cut into the next shot? I couldn't figure it out. I spent the whole night thinking about it. And at 5:30 in the morning, I figured out what to do. Unfortunately, I had to get up and go to work, so I hadn't slept all that night and decided the way to stay awake was to drink many cappuccinos. So I was standing there talking to the Orion production representative about insurance claims when directors and actors sort of get sick. And the next thing I knew, I felt my chest expand, and I said to myself, I better sit down. And then I said to myself, I better sit down right here on the floor. And then I remember someone saying, get a blanket, get a blanket. So we shut down after I was weeping hysterically saying, this is so unmanly. And I said, you know, if we shut down every time I faint, we'll never get through this movie. But the good thing about it was because I got the day off and had to go home and lie in bed, I discovered that Graham Kerr had a new cooking show. I had grown up watching The Galloping Gourmet, so it was great to turn on a TV and see this new cooking show. I was very disappointed, though, because he was someone who used to drink wine and use a lot of heavy cream, and he's sort of been co-opted, so he was drinking mineral water and cooking light dishes.
So was this the first time you ever fainted?
Yes. In fact, until I fainted, I never believed that anyone really fainted. I believed it was a scam, and there was no such thing as fainting. I didn't accept that as a physical reality.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
But now I do.
Did you feel like you were in a movie? Because that's where I've seen people faint all the time, is in movies.
Exactly. I always thought that's the only time anyone fainted also. The entire experience of making The Addams Family was very surreal, and I felt throughout the making of the movie that I was in my own kind of horrific movie.
Did you have to screen The Addams Family for test audiences?
Yes, it's a very disconcerting thing to do. What's good about it, the whole screening process is a very interesting process. What's good about it is you get to sit in a room before you've committed to finishing the movie with 300 people and hear where they're shifting in their seats, where they're coughing, where they're laughing, where they're enjoying it, where it seems boring or slow, and you pick up on that instantly. And that's the good part of screening, and I really enjoyed it. The part that's really kind of horrific is that they then have a former pollster from the Lou Harris Organization hand out these cards and ask the audience to fill them out. How would you rate the movie? Good, bad, poor, very good, excellent. And the questions get very specific. And where it gets a little bit disconcerting is the studio executives sort of use these cards as sort of, they can use them as sort of weapons, where they'll say, 72 people didn't like Fester in that scene. There were several meetings I had with Paramount executives where they would say to me, Barry, don't worry about us sort of controlling the process and all that, because we don't really have final cut. And I would say, well, I don't have final cut. The producer doesn't have final cut. Who has final cut? And they would smile and say, the audience. And it's sort of a scary way to make movies.
My guest is Barry Sonnenfeld, the director of the new film, The Addams Family. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barry Sonnenfeld. He made his directorial debut with the new film, The Addams Family. He's also a cinematographer, and the films that he shot include Blood Simple, Miller's Crossing, Raising Arizona, Big, Misery, and When Harry Met Sally. Now that you've finished making The Addams Family, do you want to continue as a director, or would you like to go back to cinematography?
It's funny. While I was making The Addams Family, I vowed I would never, ever, ever direct another movie again. But I believe that it's probably not unlike a woman in labor, that probably she vows she'll never have another child again. This is too painful. And then somehow the mind lets you forget the pain. So now I'm very excited about directing again and don't think I'll go back to shooting. I do direct and shoot commercials.
To make money?
Yes. Commercials are great things because they have a beginning and a middle and an end that's 2 or 3 weeks instead of 18 months. They're incredibly lucrative. They allow me to continue to live at home with my wife and stepchildren. And they also oftentimes are visually much more interesting than feature films. And so they're exciting artistically to work on.
What do you do, Nike and Reebok?
I've done Nike and Reebok commercials. I won a Clio a couple of years ago for a Nike commercial I did that was shot entirely from the point of view of a dog.
The directors you've worked with the most are Rob Reiner and the Coen brothers. Have you ever refused to do a shot because it made no sense to you?
I used to tell the directors I work with that I'm merely a vessel, that whatever they want me to do, I'll do. I never viewed myself as a cameraman so much as a friend of the filmmaker. So I would often get into discussions about acting or camera placement or, you know, script, and I just happened to be good at lighting and designing shots, but I viewed myself more as a fellow filmmaker than as a cinematographer. I remember once I made the mistake of telling Joel I didn't think a shot would work, and I realized that it just puts the director's hair up, you know. Ever since then, I try to do what they want me to do. I try to convince them out of it, but I'll never say this won't work. And having directed a movie, I've learned all the things a director really wants from a cameraman. And in fact, as a director, I became sort of all the things a cameraman wouldn't want from a director. For instance, directors love zoom lenses because they're fast. They let you change the frame very quickly. You can get more shots during a day. But cameramen don't like zoom lenses. They prefer to dolly or move the entire camera than to just zoom in on a lens. But it's much more time-consuming. So as a cameraman, whenever a director would say, well, let's zoom in here, I'd always say, no, we should lay some dolly track. We'll take 10 minutes. It'll be more beautiful. And the day I became a director, I was saying, no, don't worry. We'll just zoom in here. It'll be fine. Because what directors want is just coverage, is more angles, is whatever accommodates the actors. And you sort of, it's a very different hat. And I was able to lose the whole camera work aspect of it immediately. The other thing that happened to me as a director, which is kind of amusing, is that as a cinematographer, I always, when we made timed the movie, which is correct the color and decide on the brightness before it is printed, cameramen always like things very dark. And as a cameraman, I was always saying to Rob Reiner or the Coens, oh, this scene should be darker, this scene should be darker. And when I went to time the Addams Family movie as a director, I was always saying, we better lighten this scene up. It's a comedy. Let's make it brighter. And I was with my wife and the editor of the Addams Family, Dee Dee Allen, and they couldn't believe it was the same Barry Sonnenfeld that they knew as a cameraman.
Were you a film nut as a kid? Did you watch as many movies as you could get to?
No, I'm actually a film illiterate. I think I've only seen the joke on the set of the Addams Family was the only movie I had ever seen was Dr. Strangelove, which I've seen about 300 times. Growing up, I was anything but a film buff. I never went to the movies. I thought that movies sort of gave you a distorted sense of romance. I thought that, you know, also, if you weren't going to a movie with sort of a beautiful blonde woman, it meant that you were a loser. And I still hadn't met anyone, you know, sitting in the car waiting at Jones Beach. So I didn't go to movies at all. I was not a movie buff. And the only reason I went to NYU graduate film school was truly a lack of anything to do and figuring if I went to film school, it meant I was out of the workplace for 3 more years. I was very interested in still photography. I had my own darkroom and a Leica and spent a lot of time taking still photographs. But movies didn't interest me at all.
So when did they start to interest you?
Oh, I guess sometime at NYU graduate film school.
Why'd you go to film school in the first place?
Because I couldn't get a job and didn't know what I was going to do. You know, I had graduated from NYU with a political science degree, which wasn't going to get you anywhere. Spent a year off working at a lab in New York called Frenchie's Color Lab, where we would make pictures for the Marlboro ads. And I was the guy in charge of mixing chemicals, and it dawned on me that they would only let me mix chemicals at lunch when everyone else left the premises, that maybe this was not a healthy thing. So I quit Frenchie's and really, just as a whim, applied to film school. I've been very lucky that way. Whims tend to work out. You know, I was not looking to become a director. I got a call one day from an agent saying, you should be directing and I can get you work. So I signed on with him. And within 6 months, he had gotten me the Addams Family. So I just sort of wander through life looking for places to take a nap. And things sort of come my way. Napping, by the way, I highly recommend. There's not enough of it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoy your show very much.
Oh, thanks. My guest has been Barry Sonnenfeld. He directed The Addams Family. And as a cinematographer, he shot Miller's Crossing, Blood Simple, Big, Misery, and Raising Arizona. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A year ago at this time, people expected the film adaptation of The Bonfire of the Vanities to be one of the season's big pictures. But the movie bombed at the box office. Film critic Julie Salomon followed the making of the movie every step of the way. And she says a lot of the reasons the film came out the way it did have more to do with business than with art. That's the subject of her new book. Coming up, Julie Salomon gives us an insider's look at some of the things that can go wrong with big-budget films. And Maureen Corrigan tells us about a new biography of Edgar Allan Poe that refuses to romanticize him. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Despite a call from Israel for a delay in a U.S. plan to hold Middle Eastern peace talks in Washington next week, the Bush administration is pushing ahead with its date of December 4th. Late this afternoon, the last Arab holdouts, Syria and the Palestinians, said that they would be there. Barry Schweid has more from the State Department.
The quick Arab acceptances after Israel's request for delay was rejected could put Israel in a corner. It is asking for a 5-day delay, but also a shift of the talks to the Middle East after some preliminary procedural sessions in Washington. The Bush administration is holding fast, probably assuming that Israel cannot afford to be isolated and that Israel isn't about to derail the peace talks on the issue of where or when to negotiate with the Arabs. The dispute points up again how difficult the negotiations are likely to be when the parties get down to real war and peace issues. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
And the U.S. Coast Guard says it's possible that ships holding Haitian boat people along with a tent city to house them will be overflowing in 1 week's time. The Coast Guard has sent all available planes and 20 cutters to look for Haitians fleeing their homeland in overloaded boats. By this weekend, the government plans to have completed a camp to house up to 3,000 people at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Over the last 2 months, more than 5,000 Haitians have been picked up by the Coast Guard. In Yugoslavia, a fragile ceasefire worked out last weekend in Geneva appears to be generally holding, although a number of violations have been reported. As Pierre Vickery reports, UN officials have made it clear that whether or not it sends a UN peacekeeping force to the country depends on a lasting ceasefire.
Croatian radio reported a number of ceasefire violations in the east of the republic, accusing the Serbian-led Yugoslav army of mortar and heavy artillery attacks on Vinkovci and Podravska Slatina. But in most parts of Croatia, the ceasefire is holding, with only minor violations reported. The Yugoslav army is continuing its withdrawal, with convoys of military vehicles evacuating equipment and personnel from a number of federal garrisons. The United Nations mediator, Cyrus Vance, is expected back in Yugoslavia by the weekend for detailed discussions on the deployment of the proposed peacekeeping force. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Jobless claims fell by some 80,000 in the middle of the month. However, economists point out that the drop came during Veterans Day week, meaning that there were fewer days to file claims. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 16 points. This is NPR News. Working to get home for the holidays, Congress has approved a measure to provide $70 billion for the government insurance fund protecting bank deposits. The Senate approved a compromise banking bill worked out in an all-night meeting of House and Senate conferees. Earlier House members approved the bill by a voice vote. Congress has now also approved a bill to give more money to the Savings and Loan Bailout Program, enough to last until early spring. And Congress has approved a 6-year, $151 billion highway bill that supporters say will provide up to 4 million jobs. The Bush administration appears willing to accept the measure. The Transportation Secretary Skinner called a win-win compromise. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Bush has had a change of heart on the bill. Months ago, the administration gave a thumbs down on the legislation, saying it was too expensive and that the president was determined to veto it. But with the economy still sluggish, it would be difficult for the White House to reject any bill that promises to create up to 4 million jobs. Some lawmakers say it may be the only real economic growth package passed this year. The biggest dispute was over dividing up highway money to the states for projects, but negotiators assured each state would get back no less than 90 cents for every dollar it pays in to the Highway Trust Fund in gas taxes. The bill provides over $100 billion over the next 6 years for highway and bridge construction and a record $31 billion for mass transit projects. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Four NATO countries have agreed to make changes in the makeup of the Northern Command and set up a new Northwest Command in Britain. This new command will be responsible for the Baltic Sea, the English Channel, and the British Air and Land Command. Also under the plan, all of Germany will be placed under the Central Command. This is NPR News in Washington.
Fresh air. I think of myself as someone who really loves movies, but I often leave the theater restless and dissatisfied, wondering how so much money and such talent produced such a mediocre film. There are some answers in the new book, The Devil's Candy, about the making of Bonfire of the Vanities. This book is by Julie Salomon. She's film critic for The Wall Street Journal. She was given complete access to the production by the film's director, Brian De Palma. Julie Salomon told me she's also often disappointed at the movies, and researching this book helped her explain why.
It's not what you think. You know, somebody sits down, writes a script, and then the director says, gee, that's great, I'm going to go film it. Instead, it's sort of like what used to be the Politburo meeting. You know, this whole committee of people get together and think, we're making this big movie, we're going to spend, you know, 30, then 40, then $50 million. And it becomes sort of this business analysis that starts to move further and further away from the realm of art or entertainment.
Well, the film that you're looking at in your book, The Bonfire of the Vanities, was directed by Brian De Palma. Now, I think of De Palma as being being at his best when he's doing a film that has some real personal interest to him. I mean, I think of him as a very personal kind of filmmaker. But this is like, you know, a big bestseller book that was going to be a big budget movie. And De Palma didn't seem like the obvious choice. Apparently, a lot of other directors were offered this movie and turned it down. Mike Nichols, James Brooks, Norman Jewison. How did De Palma end up with it, and why didn't the other directors want to do it?
Well, I'll start with why the other directors didn't want to do it. They didn't want to do it because they thought it was impossible to do. The Bonfire of the Vanities, the book, Tom Wolfe's book, was a big, sprawling book filled with all kinds of characters, and it was a satire of New York, and it didn't have this, you know, the ingredients a movie needs are characters you can hang on to, follow through a whole story, and in 2 hours or 2.5 hours, wrap the whole thing up. Bonfire of the Vanities is like a whole, it's journalism as much, and I mean that in the very best sense of the word, as much as a novel. It tells you about a whole bunch of slices of life of a city at a particular point in time. To do that as a movie, especially a two-hour movie, seemed impossible to the directors who were approached. It seemed impossible to Brian De Palma. But he was at a point in his career, he told me that the reasons you make movies aren't always the obvious ones. And the point that he was at that time was he had made Casualties of War, which was a Vietnam picture, which he felt was his best film. I thought it was an awfully good film.
Yeah, me too.
It got very good critical reception, but completely bombed at the box office. And De Palma was very low. He felt very depressed after that. And he just wanted to get back to work. And he, you know, the scripts he was getting weren't very good. Most scripts you get aren't very good. And the chance to make Bonfire of the Vanities was very seductive. I mean, that's part of what the title of my book is, The Devil's Candy. And that's part of what that's about, the seduction of Hollywood, to think, well, maybe I can do this thing that nobody else could do. But I think you're right. It was not a personal film for him. It was more like a challenge.
So often when I go see a movie, the people who are the stars of the film just aren't very interesting, and it's people who are on the periphery, the character actors, who are the more interesting actors. And you know that a lot of the casting decisions are probably made on who the producers or the director or whatever thinks is going to be good box office. In Bonfire of the Vanities, the leading role went to Tom Hanks, which seemed like an odd choice to me because he's so boyish. you know, for somebody who's supposed to be the master of the universe. And the way you tell it, it seemed odd to Tom Hanks, too. He felt too young and, well, too boyish for the role. So whose decision was it, and why Tom Hanks?
Why Tom Hanks? Peter Guber. Peter Guber, who is now the head of Columbia Pictures, was at that time a producer at Warner Brothers, and he was riding high because Batman had come out, and it was the biggest movie of all times financially, and so Peter Guber could do no wrong. He read Bonfire of the Vanities, and he told me the instant I read that book, I said, Tom Hanks, Tom Hanks, Tom Hanks. He talks in multiples, you know. And I said, why Tom Hanks? And he said, because Sherman McCoy, who's the bond trader, the bond salesman in Bonfire of the Vanities, is not a very likable character. He's an adulterer. He participates in a hit-and-run accident. He's rich. He's works on Wall Street. He's all these things that nobody wants to identify with. And Guber thought by casting somebody like Tom Hanks in that part, the audience would automatically come to the movie with some sympathy for that character, even though he was a no-good-for-nothing. They would think he was good because he was Tom Hanks. And that was why Tom Hanks was cast in that role. I think the bigger problem was casting Bruce Willis to play the dissipated British journalist.
Yeah, this opportunistic journalist. How was Bruce Willis cast in the role?
In that case, Bruce Willis, who was riding high from the success of Die Hard, read the script or heard that Warner Brothers was making Bonfire of the Vanities into a movie, and he expressed interest in being in the movie one way or the other. Well, Tom Hanks was already Sherman McCoy. Bruce Willis couldn't be Maria Ruskin, the mistress. He couldn't be the wife. He couldn't be the Jewish judge, who at that point was still a Jewish judge. So they thought, okay, Bruce Willis can be the British journalist. I mean, it was really just as, I know it sounds flip to say it that way, but the decisions were made almost that casually.
This is an example of a movie that went over budget. It's always assumed that when a movie goes out of the budget, it's somehow it's the director's fault. Can you give us some examples of how this movie went over budget in its most typical ways? Like, what's typical that happened in this movie of how budgets just kind of spiral out of control?
Well, this movie going over budget was particularly strange because it doesn't have any special effects. It wasn't shot in Antarctica. What happened in this film was chaos. They filmed a lot because the script kept changing almost from the beginning, partly because they could never get the tone exactly the way they wanted. There was never a schedule imposed on the movie, and a schedule is probably the single most important thing in a movie in terms of the cost, because time is money. One of the things that happened to this movie was 2 weeks before they were going to start shooting, Brian De Palma and the Warner Brothers executives decided that to have racial balance in the movie, because all the blacks portrayed in the movie didn't seem like nice guys, they decided to turn the Jewish judge Kavitsky into a black. So they decided to hire Morgan Freeman. They'd already hired Alan Arkin to play the part for $120,000. Morgan Freeman wanted $650,000. So you pay Morgan Freeman $650,000, Alan Arkin $120,000, you're up to $800,000 for a secondary role. But the big problem was that Morgan Freeman's schedule didn't allow him to go out to L.A. to shoot the scenes on a soundstage courtroom that had been built on the lot at Warner Brothers. So they had to shoot these courtroom scenes in New York. And for the first 4 weeks of production, they didn't know where they were going to shoot the scenes. And the location scouts were running all over New York, New Jersey, Ohio, trying to find a courthouse where they could film these scenes. Finally, after much running around and chaos and money spent, they found a courthouse in Queens that would let them shoot, but only at night, because in the daytime there were real defendants and plaintiffs. So in the end, the cost of hiring Morgan Freeman, because they had to pay double time and triple time to shoot at night, ended up adding about $4.5 or $5 million to the movie's budget. That one casting decision.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Julie Salomon, film critic for The Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, The Devil's Candy, an inside look at the making of The Bonfire of the Vanities, which was directed by Brian De Palma. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Julie Salomon, film critic for The Wall Street Journal and author of a new book about the making of The Bonfire of the Vanities, which is a kind of case study in how Hollywood films are made and some of the things that go wrong in the process. Let's talk about something I'm really anxious to hear what you have to say on, and the subject is audience testing. I interview a lot of directors on the show, and I find most directors are very reluctant to talk about this, understandably. I don't think they particularly want to bite the hand that feeds them. but this has been a growing trend for years in Hollywood, that before a movie is released to theaters, it's screened to sample audiences who rate the movie, and then they go back and re-edit the movie based on what the audiences say, and the director loses a lot of control in the process. First, give us a sense of how audience testing works. What happens? How do they find an audience, a sample audience, to screen the movie to?
A lot of the ways they find the audiences nowadays, they use the same methodology that political pollsters use. In fact, the guy who runs a lot of the test screenings for the Hollywood studios now is a man called Joe Farrell, who came out of the Lou Harris organization. He used to do political campaign testing. And now that same kind of testing, which has made our political process such a fun thing, is now also applied to movies. And they stop people in shopping centers and ask them a few questions, or they'll send out questionnaires in the mail. There are various ways of doing it. And then the audience is invited to come to a free screening of the movie, and they're seeing the movie many times in a primitive state. It may not have gone through the final editing process, which in itself is a little bit difficult for audiences to comprehend. It's not the kind of movie they're used to seeing. So the audience sits there, they watch the movie, and then they're handed out questionnaires, which they fill out. And the questionnaires ask them very basic kind of questions. What did you like? What did you think about this star? What did you think about that star? Which sequences did you like? Then they're asked to rate it excellent, very good, good, poor, and then to give specific comments on what they did or didn't like. And then they're asked to say whether they would recommend it to a friend or not. So ultimately, you're a filmmaker, and this is a nightmare. You've thought about this, you've worked on this film for 2 years or whatever the amount of time is, and then some guy, you know, who's come off the golf course in San Diego is telling the studio how to cut your movie. And the problem with the testing process is these are not professional critics. I mean, even professional critics have a hard time evaluating complex movies. Asking somebody who, you know, this may be the first time they've ever been asked to evaluate something, they may react in a very emotional way, which is partly what the studio wants. But from the filmmaker's point of view, it's a nightmare.
What were some of the responses?
The responses go all over the place, but a lot of they're usually, I don't like Tom Hanks, think Melanie Griffith is no good, or like Melanie Griffith in her underwear. I mean, they're really goofy, a lot of them. And what they really look for are the numbers, the will recommend. What score would you, how many excellent and very goods do you get? For a movie to be considered a pretty surefire hit, it has to be in the 90s, in the 90 percentages of excellence and very good. I think with Bonfire of the Vanities, they were down in the 50 percentages of very good and excellent, and that is not good.
So how many times was Bonfire screened for test audiences, and how many times was it changed because of audience reaction?
Ultimately, 4 times, and it was changed over and over again. And the main problem they had was over the ending. And they kept changing it and flipping it around and taking endings out and putting new endings in. And by the end, I think De Palma just sort of threw his hands up and said, well, let's do this. Because you just feel kind of beaten down by the end of the process.
Here's another thing that really confuses me about Hollywood the way it is now. You hire a director because you like their vision. You think that's why you'd hire them anyways.
Right.
And because they bring a certain personal vision to the movie. And then you screen it for people who have no particular expertise in judging movies, and then you let them decide what the ending of this movie should be. It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense, but, you know, there's a point in the book where Steven Spielberg, who is Brian De Palma's closest friend, is talking about De Palma's agony, because this was an agony for him going through this process. But he said, look, if Brian De Palma directs Bonfire of the Vanities, this was a film that is not a Brian De Palma film. This is a film that any one of a number of other directors could have directed. This was not a film that came from his heart and soul. And so he said, at that point, you become, once you buy into the studio system, once you say, no, I'm not making a low-budget film that's my vision, I'm going to make a big-budget studio picture, you're buying into the system, and you can't complain too much about the rigors of that system because you've made your deal with the devil.
Brian De Palma let you in on the set, and you say once he opened up the door, he never flinched. I think very few people would welcome a journalist to watch their working process throughout the making of an entire film. Why do you think he let you do that?
I think that he wanted to have somebody who he respected, and I think he did respect my work, and who he trusted, watch what he did at work. I think that he has felt hurt by the kind of press he's gotten over the years. I think he's encouraged it in some ways by taking people on and being willing to go into head-to-head combat with journalists who have attacked him. But I think he wants to be thought of as a serious filmmaker. And yet because of the kinds of films he's made, you know, all of the comparisons between him and Hitchcock, he's never been taken seriously in the way that he wanted to. And I think he wanted to somehow demonstrate to the world that, you know, whether a movie that he makes works out, whether it turns out to be considered good or bad, there's a tremendous lot of thought and effort and work that goes into it. And I think he wanted the chance to let somebody in who might report on that. And he was willing to let me look at it warts and all, because I think his feeling is that people have kind of a simplistic idea of why a director does what he does when he or she does it. And he wanted to show all the kinds of pressures that come to bear, financial, artistic, personal, physical. There are all kinds of reasons that decisions are made, and almost none of them are what we think, what we on the outside think that they were when we analyze a movie.
Well, Julie Salomon, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Julie Salomon is film critic for The Wall Street Journal. Her new book is The Devil's Candy, The Bonfire of the Vanities Goes to Hollywood. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, Linda, how are you covering this day of the all-day, all-night Congress?
Well, Mara Liasson is up there, Terry, and she's going to tell us what it looks like as the Congress lurches toward Thanksgiving. They're considering, as you know, coming back to do something about taxes, and we're going to talk to a member of the House and to an economist about what that might mean. Also, what all of this means for President Bush, who is looking at the campaign down the road. We will also be going overseas for stories from Cambodia and from Yugoslavia, and we have a story from South Boston, Virginia, on a cookbook called Do Preachers Really Like Fried Chicken?
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the 19th century, Edgar Allan Poe's poem The Raven was so popular there was a slew of parodies, even one called The Turkey, with a line you might want to recite at your Thanksgiving dinner, "Quoth the turkey, nevermore." This information comes from a new biography of Poe by Kenneth Silverman. Silverman won the Pulitzer Prize in 1984 for his biography The Life and Times of Cotton Mather. The new Poe book is subtitled Mournful and Never-Ending Remembrance. Critic Maureen Corrigan says this biography is as haunting as some of Poe's own writing.
Here are a couple of items to add to your Thanksgiving list of things to be thankful for. Item one is Kenneth Silverman's mesmerizing new biography of Edgar Allan Poe. This is the first study of Poe that neither demonizes nor idealizes him. Instead, Silverman introduces us to the man family members called Eddie, a gloomy fellow who couldn't hold his liquor, who envied and plagiarized other writers, and who produced some of the most brilliant, disturbing fiction ever conceived. The second thing to be thankful for is that you're not Edgar Allan Poe. According to Silverman's account, Poe's life was 40 years of unrelenting misery. Poe was born in 1809 to a pair of actors. His father disappeared shortly after his birth. His more famous mother, Eliza, died when she was only 24 and Poe was 2. Poe was taken in by a childless couple, John and Fanny Allen, but they never adopted him. As he was growing up, Poe never knew where he stood with the Allens. He found out in his early 20s when Mrs. Allen died and Mr. Allen disowned him. Like Jerry Lee Lewis, Poe married his 13-year-old cousin, but theirs was no great balls of fire passion. In fact, Silverman suggests the marriage to Virginia Clemm may never have been consummated. Poe does seem to have had an aversion to physical love. If you think about it, none of the women in his works are beautiful, sexy, and alive. Over the next two decades, Poe struggled to become a literary phenomenon. His writing brought him fame, but little money. He sold his great poem, Ligeia, to one magazine for $10. And Poe picked fights with influential contemporaries like Longfellow, who might have helped him. When his wife Virginia died at age 25, Poe became unhinged. In a frenzy, he started courting four women simultaneously. He was returning from a visit to one wealthy Southern widow when he collapsed in Baltimore and died, maybe from encephalitis, maybe from the DTs. No wonder Poe once said of himself that he was not, by nature, of the merry mood. Poe's psychological tales of horror seem to me so modern that I always tend to forget how early in the history of American literature he was. But Silverman sets Poe squarely in his times. He shows, for instance, how the popularity of lurid crime stories in penny newspapers influenced Poe's invention of the detective tale. Silverman is also a sensitive interpreter of Poe's writing. He argues that Poe's childhood denial of his mother's death may account for the strange cluster of dead-alive characters in his poems and stories. Silverman says that the continuing popularity of Poe's works derives from their power to confirm beliefs from which most people have never entirely freed themselves, and which Poe's own past kept alive in him, beliefs that one can be devoured, that the darkness is astir, and that the dead in some form survive and return. Like so many of his crazed narrators, Poe was virtually engulfed by terrors that his own culture couldn't diagnose. After reading Silverman's biography of Poe, one more thing I'm thankful for is Freud.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed a new biography of Edgar Allan Poe by Kenneth Silverman. If you have any questions or comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Sue Weinstein, Sue Spolin, and Roberta Shurrock, who also directed today's show. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross. Have a good Thanksgiving.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You may have read the cartoons of Linda Barry and wondered, did that really happen to her? On the next Fresh Air, the cartoonist, playwright, and NPR commentator has some true confessions about her own childhood. And we talk with saxophonist David Sanborn. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.